Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehr Show on WNYC. I'm Bridget Bergen, senior reporter in the WNYC and Gothamist newsroom, filling in for Brian, who's off today. I hope everyone is staying warm. It is already really cold, and the temperature is dropping dangerously to low levels today. I'm sure you've heard that, so I hope everybody stays warm as well as they can. On today's show, we're going to hear from New York Magazine editor Corey Sika, who will talk about the new rules, etiquette for 2023. Plus, New York City is losing black families, at least 200,000 people over the past 20 years. We'll hear your stories about where you or your black friends and family members are moving and why. And Bronx Assemblymember Carinas Reyes will join us to react to Governor Hochul's budget proposal and talk about a new law that bans the toxic chemical mercury from beauty products. But first, it's been a week since the release of that graphic and disturbing footage of Tyre Nichols. The 29-year-old black father, brother, and son was beaten to death at the hands of Memphis police officers who were also black. Five officers have been fired and face a series of charges, including second-degree murder. On Wednesday, 3 weeks after his death, the family of Tyre Nichols gathered to mourn. Aaron Morrison of the Associated Press wrote, "The funeral on Wednesday had all the hallmarks of what's known as a homegoing service in black American communities, comforting gospel hymns, remembrances from loved ones, and a stirring eulogy from a clergyman. But in addition to the offering of an outlet for private mourning of Nichols' family and friends, this ritual was also public and political." That from Aaron Morrison. A delegation from the White House was there, led by Vice President Kamala Harris. She spoke from the pulpit and praised Nichols' parents, Rodney and Ravon Wells, for their strength. Here's about a minute of her talking about this loss, especially for his family.
Mothers around the world, when their babies are born, pray to God when they hold that child that that body and that life will be safe for the rest of his life. Yet we have a mother and a father who mourn the life of a young man who should be here today. They have a grandson who now does not have a father. His brothers and sister will lose the love of growing old with their baby brother. And when we look at this situation, this is a family that lost their son and their brother through an act of violence at the hands and the feet of people who had been charged with keeping them safe.
Several members of Nichols' family also spoke. His big sister talked about taking care of him as a little kid, how he was happy with a bowl of cereal and cartoons. When his mother, Ravon Wells, spoke, her pain was palpable.
First of all, I want to thank each and every one of you for coming out to pay tribute to my son. Yes, ma'am. Tyre was a beautiful person. And for this to happen to him, it's just unimaginable. I promise you the only thing that's keeping me going is the fact that I really truly believe my son was sitting here on an assignment. Yes, ma'am. From God. Yes, ma'am. And I guess now his assignment is done and he's been taken home.
All of the ceremony was televised, with cameras and microphones capturing each moment. My first guest, Charles Blow, New York Times columnist, wrote this week about how this case and the many that preceded it distort the grieving process for these families. Privacy is unavailable to them, he wrote. It's among the countless injustices that this and too many other families have faced. How to grapple with staggering grief while being in the public eye, and how the discussions inevitably shift to politics and what's broken systemically, even as individuals suffer, how broken they feel individually. Charles Blow is also an MSNBC analyst and author of The Devil You Know and Fire Shot Up My Bones. Charles, welcome back to WNYC. I really appreciate you joining me.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
And listeners, we want to check in with you this morning. How are you processing this past week? Have you had to talk to your children or maybe your parents about Tyre Nichols' death? Are you the mother or father of a Black child? How are you working through your fear, your anger, and your grief? Did you make a point to watch any of his funeral this week? What are the ways you have found to grieve privately, or did you seek out comfort in community? Were you inspired to protest? Give me a call at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692, or you can tweet at Brian Lehr. Charles, you attended Tyre Nichols' funeral this week. Can you talk to us a little bit about what it was like in that church and what your experience was like there?
Absolutely. First, you know, it is not the first time I've been to one of these funerals, and so some of the things that were part of the funeral were familiar to me. What we have to remember about these families in these particular kinds of cases that garner so much attention is that they become a magnet for a lot of people around the families. And so the incredible kind of entourage of dignitaries was remarkable. You know, mm-hmm. It's something that you notice. The church had three sections, one down the middle, one right and left. I don't know how many rows there were, but, you know, probably a quarter of the front sections in all three sections was reserved for dignitaries, like six or seven rows of other pastors, activists, politicians, movie directors. You know, it was, you know, that is part of what ends up happening to these families, is that their grief, their journey is no longer completely their own. They're sucked into a vortex of people saying things to them that they need to do or should do, or advising or counseling, and also them feeling that they need to do these things in order to have access to some sort of justice, to rationalize what has happened to the child, the tragedy, to make their death count in a way. Mm-hmm. And so they're, you know, they're PR lawyers all around. We're never going to go to court, by the way. There are, you know, activists, and there are other ministers, and there are people in the community, and then there is politicians, and everyone wanting them to set the tone for the grieving of the community. Right. It becomes very interesting to watch all of the pulling you can tell is happening on the family. Mm-hmm. And that shows up even in the funeral.
And there were also families of other people who died from police violence at this funeral. I understand the families of George Floyd, Botham Jean, Breonna Taylor, Eric Garner. But there were also families of people whose names, you know, some of us may not know as well. You met a mother whose son had also been killed by Memphis police. Can you tell us about her?
Yes, her name is, last name is Gates Bullard. Now the son's name was Gates. I don't have his first name. I can't remember it right now. Sorry about that. And he was killed by sheriff's deputies in Memphis. And it was part of another crazy tough on crime program called Jump and Grab, kind of undercover sting about around drug usage. And you know, they went to court. One of the sheriff deputies was convicted of violating her son's civil rights. But one of the interesting things that you're pointing out here is something that I have noticed in the 10 years that I have been covering these cases, which is that first of all, the number of mothers is legion. Like, you have no concept of how many people this is. And most of them are mothers, you know, that we were pointing out are mothers of people who died. But there's also, you know, multiples of that of mothers of people who were roughed up and lived, who were damaged, injured, and lived, mm-hmm. who we never talk about. And what they end up doing is they make pilgrimages to funerals and occasions of other mothers. It's a fascinating phenomenon that is happening. So it's a sorority of sorrow, if you want to, you know, give and deliver a thing that they bind themselves together, whether they know each other or not, whether they communicate or not, they still show up at these other funerals because the grieving has not ended for them, that there is no termination or there's no wrapping it up. Because it was a tragedy, it was a betrayal of the state of the system around you. It's almost like a betrayal of the air, right? Mm. There's something all around you. You have no choice but to be in it, and that is the thing that killed you. And so that makes it inescapable, and they're grieving about it. In my experience, just seems to never have some sort of, you know, kind of bow put on it. There's no end way for them to wrap it up. So they continue to grieve other mothers, and it resurfaces their own pain every time they hear about one of these cases.
Charles, in your latest column, it's called "This is a Moral Crime." You wrestle with some of what we talked about, that idea of how a family like Tyre Nichols is robbed of the space to mourn privately, becoming immediately the leaders of mass public mourning. And, you know, to the extent that you've described part of this sorority of mourning, can you talk about also how some of the grief experts you spoke with describe what that does to them and what they're losing in that process?
Absolutely. You know, and I will say this, it's not that these families don't have some sort of agency. There are a lot of families that choose not to mourn publicly in this way. And there's some for whom their cases just don't rise to that level, and therefore they don't even get a chance or choice in the matter about whether or not they are more public about it. But for a lot of the families, they understand that their only access to the possibility of justice is to publicly mourn, and that becomes the their loss, right? They have to make this, you know, horrible choice. I mourn silently, but that may mean that person gets away with it, or I mourn publicly and let people tap into my pain and voyeurize it, and that is the only way I have to access to that. But the grief experts were talking to me more about, you know, the ritual. There's a sacredness to mourning, and that when you have to perform your mourning, you lose some of the ability to have that sacredness. You lose the quiet space that is really important to mourning, and the reflection time, and, you know, just the sitting with a relative or a friend, someone bring you tea and you crying, and they just holding your hand. Those moments, not that these families won't have any of that. I'm sure that they will. Eventually, the television cameras will go away. Eventually, the protesting will stop. But you need that normal, natural, whatever normal natural is for you, mourning to take place. And a lot of times it's quiet. A lot of times it's not articulate. And these families are forced to articulate their feelings constantly. You know, it seems like a very normal and natural question for a news person to ask the people, how are you doing? It's actually, for some people, a very cruel question. It is an unanswerable question for them. I remember being with Tamir Rice's mother and on the 100-year anniversary of his death, and it was a program for that. At the church, I meet in the back of the church, and a woman comes up and she says, "Oh my God, I feel your pain. I'm so sorry for you." And she hugged her, and as soon as the woman walked away, she says, "I am tired of giving hugs."
Yeah.
And these people have no idea how I feel. And you could tell there was an anguish in it, the constantly having to perform, to constantly having to be present for other people's mourning that could not even compare to yours, but they are mourning about your child. It's very complicated for these families.
I was struck by, excuse me, your description of your interview of Trayvon Martin's mother, Sabrina Fulton, and the way her grief had affected her physicality, the way she gravitated to her own mother. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I met the first time I interviewed her. It was in Miami Gardens, is a neighborhood that in near Miami, and she wanted to meet at a restaurant, and so we did, and she shows up with her mother, and she showed up with her mother. It occurred to me for comfort, mm-hmm. And so as she would sat and answered questions about her own son, she wrapped her arms around her mother's arm and rested her head on her shoulder like a child would do. And you could see that she was grasping for comfort. You could see the deep grief in her, mm-hmm. And it was expressing itself literally in her body. And that was fascinating for me to watch. And also, as I'm a journalist, but also a human being, so you're trying to be very delicate about what you're seeing and sure. Understanding that this person, maybe this is not even the time for her to speak about it, but she wants to speak, and it is my job to bear witness. So it becomes complicated for us too. The very thing that I am discussing here, which is intrusion and spotlights, you are, as a journalist, you're part of that. And right. So you have to figure out, how do I also not intrude and interrupt this person's grief and mourning? So it's a very complicated situation.
I want to bring in one of our listeners. Let's go to Lex in the Bronx. Lex, thanks for calling. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, and good morning.
Good morning.
I'm blown away, literally, by how routine dealing with death, particularly in our Black community, but also in the American community. It's literally like murder is sport. And it hurts so much more this time because it's us doing it to us. It's Black people taking the lives of Black people, like literally on camera. It's like it's tailor-made for a media field day, and that's exactly what we have. I've lost family, medical emergencies. I've lost family to gun violence. I very much believe we carry our dead with us. And the pain is definitely, you know, part of that issue of grief. But what we do with it and why we keep going through it, those are questions that we have to ask ourselves. I think it's time to look in the mirror. I'm in a position where, like right now, I'm the only individual. I'm born and raised in New York. I'm from the Bronx, Albert Einstein Hospital. Mm. I'm the only individual in my family still living in America. My entire nuclear family is out, gone. They're in the islands back in the Caribbean. Mm. They're in Central America. I'm trying to get out, too. My wife is in South Africa right now looking at places. Point I'm making is we know what time it is here. We see the effects of it. Like, I can't stick around and wait for that rain to fall on me or mine because I'm already near the edge, you know? Like, it's out there. It could happen today. Like, that's just what it is. So the pain and the grief is always with us, and I feel for those who are going through it with us.
Lex, thank you so much for calling and for holding, and so you could share your feelings with all of our listeners. Charles, I want to give you a chance to respond to Lex.
It's a fascinating phenomenon that people are experiencing in this country. particularly Black people, with this issue of police violence and police killings. Police violence and police killings are not the biggest threat to anyone's life in America. It is more community violence. It is more crime on a local level that is more of a threat to your life. But we expect criminals to be criminals. We do not expect the state to also be a threat to your life. Mm. And it is the ubiquitousness of the state that makes it more threatening to a lot of people than the criminals themselves. It, you know, you can imagine, as any other person in America, in any city that you live in, you know, that your mother or whomever, father says, you know, don't go over in that area. It's a little bit more dangerous over there. Stay in this area or play here at this playground or go to that grocery store. And you kind of learn the topography of safety in your neighborhood, in your city. There is no topography of safety when you are Black in America and you're dealing with police officers, because we see these police killings everywhere, right? And it doesn't matter if you're near your home, away from your home. It doesn't matter if you're in your car, you're out of your car. It doesn't matter if you're walking, if you're running. In each of those circumstances, we have seen Black people killed by police. And so it becomes a ubiquitous threat for a lot of Black people that community violence simply does not present for most. You sometimes can make a choice to go or to somewhere where you feel less safe in a community. You can sometimes register that an area is less safe. It is different to know that anywhere you are, there is law enforcement, and the record keeps saying to Black people that you are disproportionately likely to encounter these officers in a negative way. Mm-hmm. That becomes traumatic for a lot of people.
We're going to have to take a short break. More with New York Times opinion columnist Charles Blow and your calls coming up. Stay with us. The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Bridget Bergen from the WNYC and Gothamist Newsroom, filling in for Brian today. My guest is New York Times opinion columnist, MSNBC analyst, and author Charles Blow. And we're reflecting on this past week after the footage of Tyree Nichols' death was released and his funeral on Wednesday. And listeners, we're checking in with you this morning. How are you processing this past week? And what are your thoughts about grieving privately or with others? I want to go right to one of our callers, Chris in Queens. Welcome to WNYC.
Well, thank you. Good morning. My introduction to grief was at a very young age with Clifford Glover. I was close friends with his younger brother, excuse me, Henry. And I remember when Clifford Glover was murdered in South Jamaica. Mm-hmm. I lived in Union Hall Street. He was around the corner, what was then Union New York Boulevard, now Guy Brewer. And I remember going to the funeral home at 10. I couldn't even process. I couldn't even make sense of it that we went to PS40 together. He was laying there in the casket in the suit. I just couldn't put it together. And it just keeps going on and on. I'm like the previous caller, I'm one of four boys, and all my brothers are gone. And one of my brothers got murdered in 1991. And it's like I was buried. It don't go, and it just keep happening. Mm. And when you see something like this, it's like you don't. And let me just say this about Black cops in the Black community. Nobody's more vicious to Black people in the Black community than Black cops. I can almost understand white cops, what they do, their racism, whatever way they got to become the people they are. But Black cops in our community, that what was going on over there, happens all the time. Happens all. That's why they was there, because they run rogue. But the grief turn. All I can say is the grief turns into the kind of been married 34 years ago, great kids, college graduates, but it stays with you. It's like an insanity almost. And you're scared of that call in the morning. You pick up every, the fear that you have of a call at 3-4 in the morning, because you dread them calls so you don't know what it is and what the grief turns into when you have children. And with the cops out here, it turns to fear. Sometimes I wish I never had kids, because I constantly, and I love my kids, I love my family, but you almost waiting for the day that something happens to them.
Chris.
And that's what it does to you. It breaks you down. And that's my comment. Thank
Chris,
you.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for calling. Thank you for listening. And thank you for sharing an incredibly painful story. And in that story, what part of, I think, I heard Chris raising was this sense of the idea that a police force without guardrails. And Charles, as you have noted, you and others have noted, in reflecting on Tyre Nichols' funeral, politics definitely became part of that event. I want to play a little bit more. This is Vice President Kamala Harris, who said this.
As Vice President of the United States, we demand that Congress pass the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. Joe Biden will sign it. And we should not delay, and we will not be denied. It is non-negotiable.
And later in the service, Ravon Wells, Tyre Nichols' mother, echoed that appeal.
I just need whatever that George Floyd bill, we need it passed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We need to take some action, because there should be no other child that should suffer the way my son and all the other parents here have lost their children. We need to get that bill passed.
Amen.
And because if we don't, that blood, the next child that dies, that blood is going to be on their hands.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Charles, as you wrote, Ms. Wells has been forced to shift so quickly from her own grief to being an advocate. She and her husband, Rodney, will actually go from this week of mourning to the State of the Union next week in Washington. Do you see value in bringing the Nichols family to the State of the Union?
Yes, if they want to be there. Mm-hmm. If that is part of their journey, and they were asking, they agreed to it. Yes, whatever the family needs and wants, I believe, mm-hmm. Grant them that. But there is the political side of it, and the politics of it is partly theater. Always, that's not a partisan thing. Politics is theater,
mm-hmm.
You heard there the vice president saying it's non-negotiable, but actually there was negotiation, between Tim Scott and Cory Booker, and another senator about this bill. And there are a lot of people who don't think that the administration weighed in heavily enough. It's not that you can change any senator's vote, but just pressure, public sentiment, using the bully pulpit helps. And it also sends a signal to the people who support the action that you are actively engaged. You're not sitting silently on your hands. I mean, the administration in a lot of these cases had basically, taken the position while the negotiation was happening that they were going to be a little bit more hands off, whether that be voting rights or police reform or whatever. But these things died, almost silent deaths. And not that you can't blame the administration for Republicans not voting for something, and you can't blame for Tim Scott trying to water down this police reform bill to would be almost meaningless. But that loud, vocal demand from the vice president, it would have been also nice to hear a lot of that when the bill was actually still alive and still being considered.
Mm. there were reports that the Congressional Black Caucus met with President Biden yesterday and reached some sort of legislative, you know, a package agreement, again, just a proposal, as well as some ideas for community-based solutions. You know, I think we can anticipate how some of these proposals may play out. But from your mind, how important is it that a package includes something like ending qualified immunity for police officers?
Well, you know, first of all, it's better to do this when you control all three branches of Congress than when you don't. Mm. So we already know that these go nowhere now, right? What they are laying out is a set of principles that if they could get them passed, these are the principles under, that they would want to have enacted into the legislation. So on principle, absolutely, qualified immunity is part of it. You heard Mitch McConnell say after this most recent case that, you know, he's maybe, I don't know how it was reported, but maybe open to some, you know, being able to have litigation against departments. That's actually not helpful. suing a department is suing the city, which is suing the taxpayers, and in Memphis, most of the taxpayers are black. So you're going to take my money,
right,
to pay for killing people who look like me? That doesn't make sense to me. You have to, the individual officers, just like individual doctors or individual, you know, drivers of, you know, big rigs, if you do something that costs a lot of life, you are responsible individually. That's what makes things accountable. There was a great line that, you know, Sharpton used in the funeral, which he says, you know, if you have, you're able to be sued, you have a different conversation when you leave the house with your spouse.
Right.
But like, don't go out there and be stupid and do something and make us lose our house. Mm-hmm. Don't do out there, do something, be stupid and make us lose the money for the kid to go to college. It makes you change behavior because you individually become at least, qualified immunity is about civil suits and therefore monetary compensation. But it also, that's part of your livelihood. And so it changes your conversation about that. That's important to me because individual accountability is what we're talking about, not departmental responsibility. That's right. Taxpayers will eventually pay that money, not the person.
I want to go to one of our, another one of our callers, Annette in Queens. Annette, welcome to WNYC.
Oh, same. Yes. The last caller, when he talked about Clifford Glover, he forgot to mention that Clifford Glover was only 10 years old. And so that's how, and I'm going to be 80, and I never forget what happened to him. As far as the funeral, the person who was there, who has been most of the funerals, Reverend Sharpton. So the families know exactly what their funeral and what it's going to entail. It's going to be, like you said, homegoing. He's going to be what we're going to do, what's our next move. So you're going to get it all political, and that's because they call on him because they trust him. So his message is what the one they want to hear. Now, when I'm listening to Mr. Blow, it sounds like he was critiquing the service and giving what the maybe people want more privacy, or he was more, to me, critiquing, well, maybe this shouldn't be this type of funeral. That's what I'm getting from him, but he didn't say it out loud. But from the way he was talking about performance, and that's what he was really trying to critique the funeral and saying that he didn't really think it should have been that kind of a funeral. And I disagree with him because they know Reverend Sharpton, and they know exactly what kind of funeral is going to be. And as I said, his notes are in his head, and he's been doing this many and many times. And they trust him. And that's just my opinion from what I was listening to him saying.
Annette, thank you. Thank you so much, Annette. And Charles, obviously, I want to give you a chance to respond to Annette.
No, that's not the critique. The critique is the American critique,
right,
which is that because America has not dealt with this issue, families are forced into a position where they have to wrestle with the idea that one of the only avenues to justice is to put their grief on display. And it is to call in the biggest names that you can possibly have for your for the funeral so that they can bring the cameras. One of the things that the presiding preacher said during the ceremony is that Al Sharpton doesn't just go where the cameras is. He brings the cameras. That's what the presiding minister at the funeral said. Mr. Sharpton brings the cameras and shines a light on the case so that the families can get more justice. If justice was available to these families and America made justice available to these families, you wouldn't need to have all that. But because it is not available to these families in America, and this keeps happening, as many of your callers have pointed out, then the families are put in a position where they need to have the person at the funeral who will bring the cameras. They need to have the PR lawyers. They need to have the activists show up. They need to have the cameras show up. And when all of that happens, it alters the way that mourning happens for us naturally. So the critique is not of the funeral itself. The critique is not in any way of the family's choices. The critique is of an America that will force a family into having to make the choice to make their funeral of their loved one public rather than private.
Charles, we started this conversation reflecting on that very idea, how we grieve, and this idea that this deeply private internal grappling has to go on before the cameras, in front of the microphones. But I'm also wondering, as someone who has had to cover this, as you've said, for over a decade, but, you know, how do you cope with covering so many of these stories? Is your writing a kind of meditation in some way?
Maybe it is. You know, and I work around journalists to do far more devastating coverage than me. I mean, I work at the New York Times. You have war correspondents. You know, they see more horror than you can imagine in a day, and they still file their reports at the end of the day. And you have to, you talk to them, they talk about this idea of keeping distance as best you can because you have a job to do, and it's more important to record and bear witness than to succumb to your own personal emotions about it. So you learn from other journalists how to best compartmentalize, but you are a human being, and so it affects you. When my own son was stopped at Yale, the officer pulled his gun out of his holster. That officer was also black. And I had just come out covering one of these other killings. And because of that, it's in my bones. And I freeze up because I become angry and undone because I don't want to be one of the parents that I'm writing about because I see how devastated those parents are, and I don't want to ever feel what they're feeling.
Charles, thank you so much for being with us this morning, for helping have this conversation with our listeners and listening to their stories. Charles Blow is a New York Times opinion columnist, MSNBC analyst, and author of The Devil You Know and Fire Shut Up My Bones. Thank you again for joining me on WNYC.
Thank you.